who had actually killed Mark Whalen. His name was Will Tierney, and he approached him in a bar, but he was run out of the bar because he was a half-breed. Well, as the fracas spilled out into the street, he met Jacqueline Payton, and she put a stop to the fracas, put a shaming on all of them for being a whole group of them picking on just one man. And she and Cameron walked back to her father's ranch, where her father offered Cameron a job, until Will Tierney showed up and pointed out that Cameron was a half-breed, at which point they threw Cameron out. Well, Cameron then found a group of traveling Indians who would also not accept him. I'll read the part where the oldest Indian told him why they would not accept him. "My son, when the heart is sick, men turn to new places, but they find no happiness except among their own kind. What is your kind? The white people will not have you, but you have an eye too open and wide. You are not an Indian. We cannot take you. You would bring new ways to us. You are neither white nor Indian. You must live your own life in your own world, or else you must fight the white men or the Indians until they take you in. All people are glad to have a man of whom they are afraid. Find the best man among many, and ask him. He will tell you what to do." Well, Cameron went back to Gallup, and was told the best man was Les Harmody. Well, after a knock-down, drag-out fight, because Les also didn't want to be associated with a half-breed, he won Les Harmody's respect by stepping back when Les Harmody fell to the floor, and letting him stand up again so they could continue the fight. Les Harmody went into the bar and declared Cameron a white man, and they became friends, and a month later, Les felt obliged to ride in and tell Oliver Payton, Jacqueline's father, that Cameron still intended to kill the three men he had sworn to kill when they threw him out of Payton's house. I'll read the exact words here. "I'll leave the place and never come back," said Cameron, "but if you handle me, I'll return and kill you one by one, I swear to God." And then they threw him out the window. Les Harmody let Oliver Payton know that a promise is a mighty sacred thing to that Cameron. Now, after Les Harmody had delivered his message to Oliver Payton about Cameron still coming after his boys and Will Tierney, Les left the house. Jacqueline quickly followed him because she wanted to convince Cameron not to kill her brothers and Will Tierney. We're picking up just as she comes up on Les Harmody.
"That you, Jacqueline?" asked Harmody as she came up. "What's wrong?"
"Nothing much," she answered. "Cameron is after my two brothers. He'll probably kill them, or they'll kill him, and that won't make me any richer."
"What do you want to do?" he asked.
"I want to beg John Cameron to leave the country."
"It's no use," said Harmony. "He won't go."
"I want to try, though. I have to try to persuade him."
"Do you like Cameron?"
"I like him a lot."
"Well, come along, then. A woman can always do what a man can't manage. I've begged him hard to give up this job. He's been like a stone, though."
They rode on together, leaving the trail presently, and plunging into a thicket of brush higher than their heads. Finally, through the dark mist of brush, she could see the pale gleam of a light that showed them into a small clearing where the ruins of a squatter's shack leaned feebly to the side, ready to fall. By the fire, Cameron answered the call of Harmony. "Who's coming with you?" he snapped. "What made you—" He broke off when he saw the girl. He had been thinner when he last talked to her, but he looked older now. Across one cheekbone was the jagged red of a new scar, which time, perhaps, would gradually dim. He wore better clothes. Perhaps they helped him to a new dignity. She went straight up to him when she had dismounted and offered her hand.
"The last time I insulted you by keeping silent when I should have spoken up," she said. "Can you forgive that, John?"
He took her hand with a touch softer than that of a woman. His grave eyes studied her face. "They told you the truth," he said. "I am a half-breed."
"It isn't the blood, it's the man that counts," she answered.
"And I'm beginning to realize what a man you are. I guessed it when we walked up that road together. I knew it when I heard what you'd done to Les Harmony.
It's because I know what a man you are that I've come here tonight."
"Les should never have brought you," said he.
"She followed me, John," protested Harmony. "Don't be hard on me about that. What was I to do? And besides, I thought that she might show you the best way out of this whole mess."
"That's it, of course," said Cameron gloomily. "I have to be persuaded. But there's no good in that, Jacqueline. There's no good at all. I've given a promise that I'll have to keep." She was silent.
"You see how it is," said the grumbling voice of Harmony. "Nothing can budge him."
"There's only one thing I wish," said Cameron, "that none of them meant anything to you."
"Why do you wish that?" she asked him.
"You remember when we walked up the road together?"
"I'll never forget that."
"If I could keep you from sorrow, I'd like to. You know, Jacqueline, now that I see you here and remember that some of your look is in your brother's, I don't think that I could harm them. But Tierney, I know you're going to marry him. Tierney has to be rubbed off my books."
"He's nothing to me," said the girl.
"He has to be. You're marrying him," exclaimed Cameron.
"I give you my word and my honor he's nothing to me tonight, because I think, I really think, that he did the frightful thing you told me about."
"You're through with him?"
"Yes."
"I don't believe that," said Cameron sternly. "If you love a man, you'll never give him up, even if he has 1,000 murders on his back."
"It was never love. It was simply growing up together and going riding and dancing together and being encouraged by everyone."
"Ah," said Cameron, "would a woman marry a man for no better reason than that?" She felt the scorn and the horror in his voice. She flushed.
"I'm afraid we do," she answered. "John, have you become so hard, so stern? Is there no use my trying to talk to you?"
"I can listen to you better than I can listen to running water in the desert. Sit down here, Jacqueline, here by the fire.
That's better. I can see your eyes now, you know. Whenever they stir, my heart stirs. When you look up at me like this, my heart leaps like a fish."
"Hey," said Les Harmony, "you can't talk to a girl like that."
"Can't I?" asked Cameron, startled. "Have I said something wrong?"
"Not a word," said the girl.
"Help me to teach him something," said Harmony. "All he knows is hunting and reading. He don't know nothing about people. You can't let a gent talk to you like that."
"Why not? I like it," said she.
"But doggone it, Jacqueline, unless he loves you or something like that."
"I do," said Cameron.
"Does that make it all right?"
"Hey, wait, wait, wait," shouted Big Les Harmony. "What's the matter with you? You've only met her once before."
"It's true," said Cameron, "but that was more happiness in a few minutes than all the rest of my life put together."
"Well, then you gotta learn not to say everything you think right out loud to a girl. They ain't used to it. You gotta spend a lot of time approaching a woman. You gotta be more doggone particular than when you come up on the blind side of a horse. Ain't I right, Jacqueline?"
"Not about John," she answered.
"Hold on. What's his special edge on the rest of us?"
"I don't know," said the girl, "but I like everything he says."
"Hold on, Jacqueline," shouted Harmony. "Hold on there. If you get ideas into his head, you'll never get them out again."
"I don't want to get them out again," she answered.
"Don't say that. I mean, explained Harmony, "that if you give him half a chance, he'll start raging like a dog on forest fire."
The girl smiled up at Harmony.
"You know a lot about girls, Les," she said, "but John Cameron happens to know a lot about me."
She put out a hand and touched the arm of Cameron.
"That's why I've had the courage to come up here tonight," she said. "It couldn't go on, John. You couldn't take the blood trail behind my brothers."
"No," said Cameron breathlessly, leaning towards her. "I couldn't lay a finger on them."
"And Tierney, leave him to the law. There is a law for that sort of man."
"I can't leave him. I told you that before. If you'd been raised by Wayland and then found him dying as I found him, wouldn't you despise yourself if you waited for the law to do your work on the murderer?"
She held her breath, fighting back the answer that rose into her throat, but it burst out in spite of her.
"Yes, I would," she exclaimed. "I don't blame you a bit."
"Quit talking that way," commanded Harmony. "Do you know that you'll have him out raising hell right away if you talk to him like that?"
"I'm only begging one thing," said the girl. "You've held your hand for a month. Will you wait another month before you take that trail? Will you let the law see what it can do, first of all?"
He dropped his face between his hands and stared at the fire. Les Harmony, making vast, vague signs of encouragement from the background, tiptoed to a little distance. The girl looked up at the giant with a flashing smile of confidence. And John Cameron had raised his head to answer, the trouble gradually clearing away from his eyes, when the voice of Tierney barked from the edge of the brush.
"Stick up those hands! Fast!"
"What in hell?" began Harmony.
"You're out of this, Les!" shouted the voice of Joe Peyton.
Cameron had risen to his feet. The girl threw herself in front of him.
"Joe, don't shoot!" she screamed. "Will, don't shoot at him! The poor fellow didn't mean anything! He only has half a brain, Will!"
Will Tierney came out from the brush at a strange, gliding pace, his feet touching the earth softly for fear that he might upset his aim, and his revolver held well out before his body.
"Get away from him, Jack!" he shouted. "Step away, or I'll get him through you, by God!"
Cameron had waited a single second, stunned. His gun belt and gun had been laid aside, his hands were empty, and death was stalking him. But what really mattered was that the girl had called him a half-wit. Had she come merely for the purpose of holding him and Les Harmony helpless while her fighting men came up to wipe out the breed? He thought of that. Then he turned and dived for the brush. He ran as a snipe flies, dodging rapidly from side to side and yelling,
"Harmony, it's my fight! Stay out of it!"
He heard the scream of the girl, then the guns began to boom. Bullets whistled past his head right and left, and then the sudden thunder of Les Harmony's voice broke in. The gunfire continued, but the bullets no longer whirred past him. The brush crashed before his face. He was instantly in the thick gloom of the foliage, safe for that moment, and he heard the shrill cry of the girl.
"Will, you've killed Les Harmony!"
That voice struck him to a halt. He stood gripping at the trunk of a young sapling until the palm of his hand ached, and behind him he heard Harmony's deep, broken voice exclaiming,
"I'm all right, Jacqueline. Don't you worry about me. I'm all right. But I tell the rest of you, for your own good, don't go into that brush after Cameron. If you go in there, he'll kill you as sure as God made wildcats. Keep out of the darkness. He ain't got a gun, but he's got hands that are almost as good as a gun."
They did not press into the brush, but Will Tierney exclaimed,
"Here's hell to pay. It's a breed that ought to be lying here, not Harmony. Les, it's your own fault. If you hadn't got in between me and my aim, I'd have Cameron dead as a bone. He dodged, damn him. He dodged like a bird in the air. I never saw such a rabbit."
"You never saw such a man-eater either," declared Harmony, "and he'll chaw your bones one day, Mr. Murderer Tierney."
"Murderer?" shouted Tierney. "You mean to say that you believe his yarn about me?" "Stop talking, Les," commanded the girl. "Save your breath. Help me carry him into the shack, Joe. Harry, take his shoulders. Does that hurt you, Les? Gently, boys."
Back to the edge of the clearing ventured Cameron, and from the thick of the brush watched the men carrying huge Les Harmony through the open door of the shack. Will Tierney, coming back into the clearing, kicked some more fuel onto the fire and made the flames jump. This brighter light seemed to be a comfort to him. He walked in an uneasy circle around the fire, staring toward the brush constantly. In the meantime, the conference inside the cabin could be heard clearly as it progressed. They were examining the wound of Harmony. Once he groaned aloud as though under a searching probe. Then the girl was saying,
"He ought to have a doctor. I'll stay here with him. But he ought to have a doctor by the morning. The three of you go straight for town."
"I'll stay here with you, Jack," said Harry Peyton.
"You'll do nothing of the kind," she answered. "What if John Cameron knew that there was only one man here?"
"He hasn't a gun," said Harry Peyton. "He has his wits in his hands, and that's enough," said Big Les Harmony. "Jacqueline is dead right. The three of you stay close together all the time."
Tierney stepped to the door of the shack.
"Bah," he snarled. "I'd like nothing better than to tackle him alone. I'd love it." "I think you like murder better than you would ever like fightin'," said Les Harmony. "When you're on your feet," answered Tierney, "I'll give you your chance at me any time."
"Thanks," said Les Harmony. "I'll take you up on that one day."
"Oh, be still," commanded the girl. "The three of you start riding and start now. Keep bunched. Head for gallop and get Doc Travis. We don't have to worry about Les for a while. Those big ribs of his turn the bullet a bit, and it's better to have broken ribs than a bullet through the heart. Will, you fired to kill."
"The fool came in my path," said Tierney. "What else was I to do? He came between me and Cameron."
"Who gave you the right to murder John Cameron?" she demanded.
"You talk as though I were a butcher, Jack."
"I think you are," she answered.
Strange joy rushed through the brain of Cameron as he listened.
"Jack," cried Tierney, "does it mean that you are through with me?"
"I never want to see your face again," she replied.
Tierney strode into the shack, shouting something that was lost to the straining ears of Cameron, because all the men were speaking at once. Then, through a pause, Cameron could hear Tierney crying out,
"You prefer a breed, maybe."
"I prefer John Cameron. I don't care what you call him," she answered.
Not care? Not care, even when he was called a breed? Did she, in truth, prefer John Cameron? He, lingering on the trembling verge of the firelight, the shadows wavering across his eyes, felt a weakness in the knees, a vague and uncertain awe. The brothers were protesting. Harry Peyton was thundering,
"Jack, you don't mean it. You can't mean it. A dirty half-breed. I'd rather see you."
"Shut your mouth, Harry," said the profound voice of Les Harmody. "Don't you speak to her like that."
The three men came striding out of the shack a moment later.
"It's no good," Tierney was saying. "You can see that she's hypnotized by that rat of a Cameron. Joe, I'm going to have the killing of him."
"Not if I can get to him with a gun first," answered Joe.
They went away across the clearing hastily, and as the brush closed after them, cracking behind their backs, there was a great impulse in Cameron to run forward to the shack and show himself for one instant to the girl he loved and to Les Harmody, who with his own body had stopped the bullets that were intended for his friend. Some rich day would come when he would have a chance to show Harmody that he was ready to die for him. He could understand, too, why the girl had called him a half-wit. It had been her first gesture toward stopping the attack of Big Will Tierney, to assure him that his rival was a creature of no importance. But there was something more for Cameron to do than to speak to the woman he loved, or to touch the hand of his friend. He had to strike Tierney. If God would let him, he had to strike at Tierney now, and he was on foot, he was weaponless, and there were three men against him, two of whom were sacred from any serious injury at his hands. As the idea dawned in the mind of Cameron, it seemed at first totally absurd, but he knew that Tierney would probably get out of the country as fast as possible. Tierney had lost his chance at the rich marriage. There now hung over his head the accusation of murder, and there was nothing to hold him in this part of the world except, perhaps, a desire to wipe out Cameron. But the great chances were that Tierney would ride with the Peytons, go as far as Gallup, deliver the message to the doctor, and then slip away towards an unknown destination. There was no time to catch him, therefore, except on this night, and already the horses of the three were galloping steadily away. They would turn down through the hills and take the long, straight road offered by Lucky Chance Ravine, which pointed straight on at the town of Gallup. It was his consciousness of the probable course they would follow that taught Cameron what he could do. The riders would have to wind down through the hills to come to the head of the steep-walled ravine. For his own part, he could strike out straight across and climb the walls wherever he chose. As he ran, he made his hands work. He snatched off his shirt, tore it into strips, and began to knot the tough strings together. He could have laughed to think that this was his weapon against three mounted armed men. Meantime, he had been running as few people can. He had left the woods, slipped through a pass between two hills, and so found himself on the rim of Lucky Chance Ravine. It ran straight east towards Gallup, bordered with cliffs to the north and south, sheer faces of rock. It was not hard to get down the cliff face. On the level floor of the ravine, Cameron dodged among the rocks until he came to a narrows, where the only clear passage was a 10-foot gap between two very large rocks. This was the strategic point for him. It was the thought of this gap, through which the riders must pass in single file, that had started him for Lucky Chance Ravine, and now he heard the distant clattering of hoofs that moved towards him with the steady lope which Western horses understand, that effortless, pausing swing of the body, slower than any other gallop. He had very little time for his preparations, but his plan was simple enough. He knotted one end of his clumsy rope around a ragged projection on the side of one boulder, then he crouched beside the other great rock, with the loose end in his grip. The slack of the twisted rope lay flat on the ground. He had hardly taken his place before he saw them coming. He was crouched so low that he could see the heads and shoulders of the two in the lead against the stars, so that they seemed to be sweeping through the sky. Well behind them came the third party. He prayed that that last rider might be Big Will Tierney. He gauged his moment with the most precise care, then jerked up the rope and laid his weight against it. Well below the knees of the horse the rope struck. There was a jerk that hurled Cameron head over heels, but as he rolled, he saw horse and rider topple. As he scrambled to his feet, the Mustang was beginning to rise, snorting, and the rider lay prone and still at a little distance. Cameron caught the reins of the Mustang and led it to the fallen rider. He had to lean close to make out the features of the man in the dull starlight, and with a groan he recognized Joe Peyton. He thrust his hand inside Peyton's shirt and pressed it above the heart until he felt the reassuring pulsation. Not dead, but badly knocked out. He got Joe Peyton's gun and flung himself on the back of the horse. It was at full gallop in a moment, speeding after the distant beat of hoofs. He rushed the horse, pressing its flanks with his spurs, and so the leading pair of riders came back to him through the night, growing visible, then larger and larger. "All right, Joe," shouted Harry Peyton. He uttered a wordless whoop for answer, and the leaders sped on, unsuspicious. He could distinguish them one from the other now. Will Tierney was in the lead. Harry Peyton was two or three lengths behind Tierney. Therefore, it was beside him that Cameron rushed his Mustang, bringing the horse up so fast that Peyton had only time to twist in the saddle and cry out once in astonishment, for he could see now the gleam of the bare skin of Cameron. His cry was cut short. A clip across the head struck with the long barrel of Cameron's revolver dropped Peyton out of his saddle. Cameron, catching the loosened reins of the other horse, jerked the Mustang to a halt, and at the same time the yell of Will Tierney flashed across his brain. Men said that Will Tierney feared nothing human. He must have thought then that half-naked Cameron was a devil and not a man, for he dropped himself low over his saddle bow, gave his horse the spur, and raced it towards the distant lights of gallop. Cameron had a strange feeling that luck was with him, that having helped him pass the first two stages of his night's work, it would not fail him in the last important moment. But he found that Tierney was drawing away from him. Big Will Tierney, twisting in the saddle, tried three shots in rapid succession and missed his mark, but to Cameron there would be no proper revenge in merely shooting a fugitive through the back. That would not repay him for the death of his friend, so he held his fire and rode harder than before. In another moment he had his reward. The far finer horse of Tierney had opened up a gap in the beginning, but the much greater weight of Tierney made up the difference after the first burst of speed. His mount began to flag, while the tough Mustang that labored between the knees of Cameron gained steadily. Tierney dodged his horse through a nest of boulders. The Mustang followed like a true cutting horse on the tail of a calf. Cameron was not a length behind when Tierney turned and fired again. And the Mustang went down like a house of cards. The earth rose. Cameron's head struck fire through his brain. He fell into a thick darkness and lay still. When he roused at last, he was dripping with water. Another quantity of it had been sloshed over him by the figure that stood tall and black against the stars. A groan had passed involuntarily through the lips of Cameron. "Coming to, kid?" asked Tierney's voice cheerfully. "I thought you'd never come around. Are you feeling better?" Cameron tried to move, but found that his legs and hands had been bound together with something harder and colder than twine. Then he realized that he had been bound with wire, hard bound, so that the iron ground the flesh against the bones of his wrist and his ankle. He stared up at the stars and found them whirling into fire. Nearby there was the sound of swiftly whispering water, and gradually he realized what had happened, and the sort of a death that he was likely to die. "I'm to go the way that Mark Wayland went, eh?" asked Cameron. Tierney had been carrying the revivifying water from the creek in Cameron's hat. Now he swished the hat idly back and forth, the final drops whipping into Cameron's face. "Sure you're going the way of Mark Wayland, but to hell with him. Think about yourself." "Wayland," said Cameron, as the confession came from Tierney, "never did harm to anyone. Why did you murder him?"
"Want to know what he did to me?"
"Nothing wrong," declared Cameron.
"If you say that again, I'll kick your face in," said Tierney. "Listen, 5 years ago, when I was feeling pretty good, I got into a fight with a greaser fool. I never had any use for breeds and greasers."
"I know," answered Cameron. He was trying to think. Mark Wayland had always said that a good brain could cut a man's way through any difficulty. What device could he find to free himself from the danger of death now? At least he might keep Tierney talking for a little time. Every moment saved was a chance gained in that sense.
"This greaser,"
said Tierney. "Caught me down on the floor of the barroom, and I pulled out a gun and let him have some daylight through his belly. He kicked himself around in circles and took a long time to die. You never heard anything like his screaming. I hung around and listened to the last of it, and that was where I was a fool. There were half a dozen people around, but they felt the way I did, that killing a greaser was always self-defense. Then another man came, Mark Wayland. He heard what had happened and started for me. I pulled the gun on him, but he was a little faster." Tierney rubbed his right arm. "Clipped me through the arm so that my gun dropped, and then he turned me over to the sheriff. The sheriff didn't want to pinch me, but after Wayland had done the pinching, the law started working. Nothing but murder, and he headed me straight for the rope. But I managed to work my way out of the jail one night. That's one of the good things about this country, their cheesecloth jails." He recommenced on the theme of Wayland. "You were saying that Wayland never did anybody harm. If I'd have hanged, that would have been harm, wouldn't it? And living these years, never knowing when somebody might turn up and recognize me, that wasn't harm, eh?"
"Did Wayland recognize you?" asked Cameron.
"I had a mask over my mug. I lay up there behind the rocks and watched you start out hunting. Then I slipped down to the shack and winged him over the head. It was easy. I wired him up, touched a match to his clothes to wake him up. He wakened with a holler, too, like the sort of a noise that greaser made on the barroom floor."
It was strange, and at the same time a horrible thing, to look straight into the mind of a man without the slightest sense of right and wrong.
"He wasn't yelling at the end," remarked Cameron.
"Nah, he shut up as soon as he realized. Too much brood in him, like an Indian, pride and all that."
Big Will Tierney sat down on a convenient rock and lit a cigarette.
"I thought that he'd break down," he said, "when I pointed out what I was going to do, light the cabin and let him roast like pork. But he locked up his jaws and didn't say anything. A queer thing, Cameron. I was almost scared from just sitting there and looking into the cold of his eyes. It almost made me think of hell, you know."
"And you went ahead," muttered Cameron.
"Wouldn't I have been a fool not to? I'd found the gold in the sacks. I needed that money, and needed it damn bad. Old Peyton was too dead set against me marrying his girl unless I showed that I was able to take care of her. He said that he'd never put up the money for me to live easy. He's always seen through me a little. He's the only one of the Peyton family that has until you came along, damn you."
There was no particular venom in that last speech. He shrugged his shoulders and went on. "Not that I give a damn about having Jacqueline wise to me. I never cared a rap about her. But I wanted her slice of the Peyton money when it came due. That old swine has a couple of million, you know that?"
"I knew that he had money."
"Where did you kill the greaser?"
"You'd like to use that on me, wouldn't you? Why, it was a little side trip made down to Phoenix when I was a kid. If you live till tomorrow, you're welcome to use the news wherever you please."
Tierney laughed. He had a fine, mellow-sounding laughter, and the strength of it forced back his head.
"But damn the Peyton money," he went on. "I'll get along without it. I would have had to play a part with Jacqueline all my life anyway, and I don't like to do that, unless I decided to raise so much hell with her that the old man would buy me off with a good lump sum. I've never had to work my way, and I never will have to. Always too many suckers like you and Wayland. They dig out the coin, and the wise birds like me get it." He laughed again.
The brain of Cameron was spinning.
"Tell me something, will you?" he asked.
"Sure, I'll tell you anything you want to know. It's sort of a pleasure that I've never had till now. Talking what I please to a fellow who's going to be dead inside of a few minutes, it's like whispering secrets into a grave, kid."
He began to laugh again, highly pleased by this thought.
"Well, tell me if you ever had a friend."
"Friends? I've had a dozen of 'em. Look at the two Peyton fellas. I've got the wool pulled over their eyes a yard deep. Sure, I've had friends. I get a friend, use him, chuck him away. That's my idea. Now let's talk business."
"What kind of business?"
"The way you're a-going to die."
"There's the creek."
"You'd like that," agreed Tierney. "Sure you'd like it, but I want to have it longer and sweeter. Maybe you're not like Wayland. Maybe you'll pipe up some music for me, the same as the greaser did."
"Maybe," said Cameron through his teeth.
Tierney stood up and stretched.
"Tell me something. You think you broke the skulls of both Harry and Joe?"
"No, they're only a little knocked out," answered Cameron.
"Too bad," murmured Tierney. "They're a pair of wooden dummies, and I'm tired of 'em. But what am I going to do about you, old son? I've got matches. How about lighting you up here and there and watching you roast? As long as you liked Wayland so much, you might as well go to hell the same way he went."
he leaned over Cameron. "I think I'll have to take that pair of spurs, though," he decided. "Where'd you get golden spurs?"
"My friend gave them to me. Les Harmony."
"The hell he did! Why would Les be chucking away money on a breed like you?"
"He said it was to show that he thought I was as good as any white man."
"Did he? Well, you're not, understand? When I've taken these spurs off, I'll show you what I think about you."
He leaned still farther. With an instinctive reaction, Cameron pulled his feet away, doubling his knees high.
"Good," said Tierney. "Going to be some struggling, eh? That's what I want. That's what I like. Put up a good fight, kid. I hate to hook a fish that won't do some wiggling. I'll have you screeching like the greaser on the barroom floor before I'm through with you."
He stepped forward to catch Cameron by one foot. His head was low, the target was not unattainable, and Cameron let drive with his heels at the head of Tierney. With the golden spurs of Les Harmony, he struck out, making his supple body into a great snapping whiplash. Tierney, seeing the shadow of the danger at the last instant, yelled out and tried to dodge, but the spurs tore across the flesh of his chin and the heels themselves thudded against the bone of his jaw. He fell on his face. Cameron came to life, moving as a snake moves. He got the revolver from the holster at the side of Tierney first. The big fellow already was beginning to move a little as Cameron held the weapon in both hands, and with two bullets severed the wires that bound him at the knees and at the ankles. It was a harder and almost impossible task to get a bullet through the wires that confined his two wrists. To manage that, he had to hold the Colt between his feet, pressing his wrists over the up-tilted muzzle of the gun until one strand of the wire was against the muzzle of it, but he could not keep the flesh of the wrists from pressing over the muzzle together with the wires. He managed to get the middle finger of his left hand over the trigger of the gun. Another extra pressure and the explosion followed. Hot irons seemed to tear the soft flesh inside his wrists, but his hands were free, and there was Tierney on his feet at last, staggering a little, then snatching at a second gun as he realized what had happened. Cameron shot low, aiming between the hip and the knee, and saw the big fellow pitch to the side. He struck on both hands, the gun spinning to a distance. Then he reclined there, as though he had been struck down by a spear and pinned to the ground.
"By God, it's not possible!" shouted Tierney. "Cameron, don't shoot! For God's sake, don't shoot!"
Cameron went to the fallen gun and kicked it back to Tierney.
"I ought to cut you down and kill you the way you were going to murder me, Tierney," he said. "But I'm not going to do that. Whalen taught me a different way of living. There's the gun inside your reach. Grab it up. Fill your hand. Take your chance."
"What chance?" groaned Tierney. "I'm bleeding to death. Cameron, do something. Help me. If you try to shoot it out now, I won't lift a hand. It'll be murder. It'll damn your soul to hell. For the sake of God, don't kill me."
"Look," said Cameron, "I'm sitting on the ground exactly like you now. I'm putting the gun down just the way yours is lying. Now fill your hand and fight, you yellow dog." But Tierney, spilling suddenly forward along the ground, buried his face in his arms and began to groan for mercy. That was why Cameron, his soul sick with disgust, brought Tierney into the town of Gallup with the feet of his prisoner tied under the belly of the horse. A crowd formed instantly. Men ran from the saloons, and some of these were sent off to rouse the doctor and prepare him for a trip. Tierney, when he saw familiar faces, began to make a frantic appeal.
"Bob! Sam! Bill! Hey, Bill! Help me out of this! The damn breed shot me from behind! I'm bleeding to death! Bill, are you going to let me go like this?"
He held out his hands in appeal. Cameron rode beside him with no gun displayed. He made a picture that filled the eyes of men, however, and kept them at a distance. For blood had run and dried from a thousand scratches, and naked as he was to the waist, he looked like a savage come back from war with a captive. Harry Peyton and the gray-headed sheriff appeared at the same time, Harry shouting,
"There he is, Sheriff! There he is now! I'll help you get him!"
Harry Peyton had a thick bandage around his head, but otherwise he appeared perfectly well. He was pulling out a gun as he ran. The sheriff stopped that.
"If there's any gun work wanted, I'll call for it," he said.
The crowd had become still thicker. Men held back from actually stopping the progress of Cameron, but they drew nearer and nearer.
"Are you the sheriff?" Cameron called out.
"I am," said the other, wading through the crowd.
"Then I'm turning Tierney over to you," said Cameron. "I'm charging him with the murder of Mark Wayland."
The sheriff came up panting. Harry Peyton was at his shoulder, glowering, ready for battle.
"You let me down, Harry, damn your heart!" snarled Tierney.
"What's this charge of murder?" demanded the sheriff. "Are you wounded, Tierney? This looks like a damn black knight's work for you, Cameron.
"Hold that horse, Harry. Help me get Tierney off his horse. Cut that rope."
Now that the horses were stopped, the men pressed suddenly close from every side. There was a shout from the rear of the crowd.
"Hang the damn breed! Lynch him!"
Cameron leaned from the saddle and gripped the shoulder of the sheriff.
"Are you going to listen to me?" he demanded,
and the green glare of his eyes struck a sudden awe through the man of the law.
"I'm listening to you. What's this talk about murder?"
"He killed Mark Wayland. He confessed it to me tonight."
"Confessed? What made him confess?"
"When he had me lying on the ground and tied with wire, the way he tied Wayland before he burned down the shack at the mine."
"What kind of liar will you listen to, Sheriff?" demanded Big Will Tierney. "He shot me from behind."
"Here's one proof," said Cameron, and he held out his wrists, with the blood still trickling from them, and the powder burns were horrible to see. The sheriff frowned, and a curse of wonder escaped his lips.
"It's true," he said suddenly.
"You'll find the wound in his leg, whether he was shot from behind or not," said Cameron. "And if you want to know more than that, send down to Phoenix. They've wanted him for murder there for 5 years. They'll want him still." He said it loudly, and the muttering of the crowd was blanketed in a sudden silence. The sheriff said,
"Look at me, Tierney. Is this true? Have you been a damn wolf in sheepskin all this time?"
"Wait a minute," yelled Tierney. "You wouldn't believe a breed against a white man's word, would you? You wouldn't."
"Shut up," said the sheriff. "You're under arrest. Cameron, I can see that I've got to thank you for doing a job that I should have handled myself. Tierney, you look as guilty as hell, and hell is where you'll wind up with a hangman's rope to start you on the way."
It may have been that the loss of blood and the successive shocks to his nerves had weakened Tierney, but now, at the very moment when he should have rallied himself to make a last desperate appeal to the crowd, which might have favored him, his nerve gave way. With one hand he gripped at his throat, as though already he felt the rope about it, and slowly turning his head, he stared at Cameron, a look that Cameron would never forget. Then they carried him towards the jail. The sheriff lingered to say loudly,
"The next man I hear calling Cameron a breed had better come and call me the same thing. There's no dirt on his skin that soap won't take off."
It was the same fellow who had yelled for a lynching who now started a new demonstration. Cameron marked him dearly. Perhaps seeing how the wind was blowing from this unexpected quarter, the man wanted to bury his other remark under new fervor. But he it was who proposed cheers for Cameron, who's all white, and the crowd, falling into the spirit of the thing, cheered itself hoarse and then dropped back into the saloons to start a celebration. Cameron himself by that time was riding at the shoulder of the doctor, with Harry Peyton on the other side of him and Joe Peyton in the rear. The brothers said nothing. They were not the kind to waste words, but neither, Cameron was sure, were they the sort to nourish grudges. And that was how they came back to the shack where Big Les Harmody was lying. When he heard them coming, Harmody shouted a question. The voice of Cameron answered, and a cry of happiness broke from the throat of the wounded man. There was not much need of talk. When Harry and Joe, who had started with Tierney, returned with Cameron and the doctor, it was a fairly clear proof that everything was altered in the affairs of Cameron. There was one anxious pause while the doctor made his examination of Harmody. Then the medico looked up with a smile.
"Luck and an extra heavy set of ribs have saved you, Harmody," he said.
An involuntary gasp of relief broke from the lips of Cameron, and hearing that, Harmony held out a sudden great hand toward him.
"Old son," he said.
Cameron caught the hand and gripped it as hard as he could. "The two of us, Les," he exclaimed.
"Fine," said Harmony, "but suppose we make it three."
He looked across at the girl, and she, from her place beside the bed, forced her head up until she was looking with great eyes straight at Cameron. She began to smile in a way half fond and half foolish, and Cameron knew that he had reached the end of pain.
I came across a book called Spoon River Anthology. This is by Edgar Lee Masters, and it's a whole group of poems about different people who were buried in a particular cemetery. There's an introduction here that explains it further. Originally conceived as a novel, having the ingredients of a fatalistic drama, as well as those of a tract on social injustice, the anthology is a series of poetic monologues by 244 former inhabitants, both real and imagined, of Spoon River, an area near Lewiston and Petersburg, Illinois, where Master spent much of his boyhood. All in the cast are dead. All are sleeping on the hill of a Midwestern cemetery. and from their graves they speak their own epitaphs, discovering and confessing the real motivations of their lives. They reveal the secret steps that stumbled them to failure, or raised them to illusionary triumphs while alive. It is as if the darkness of the grave granted them revelatory eyes for recognition of their own souls. I will read a few of these here, certainly not all 244. We'll start with Jacob Goodpasture. When Fort Sumter fell and the war came, I cried out in bitterness of soul, O glorious Republic, now no more. When they buried my soldier son, to the call of trumpets and the sound of drums, my heart broke beneath the weight of 80 years, and I cried, O son who died in a cause unjust, in the strife of freedom slain, and I crept here under the grass. And now from the battlements of time, behold, thrice 30 million souls being bound together in the love of larger truth, wrapped in the expectation of the birth of a new beauty, sprung from brotherhood and wisdom. I, with eyes of spirit, see the transfiguration before you see it. But ye infinite brood of golden eagles, nesting ever higher, wheeling ever higher, the sunlight wooing of lofty places of thought, forgive the blindness of the departed owl. William H. Herndon. There by the window in the old house, perched on the bluff, overlooking miles of valley, my days of labor closed, sitting out life's decline. Day by day did I look in my memory, as one who gazes in an enchantress's crystal globe. And I saw the figures of the past, as if in a pageant glassed by a shining dream, move through the incredible sphere of time. And I saw a man arise from the soil like a fabled giant, and throw himself over a deathless destiny, master of great armies, head of the Republic, bringing together into a dithyramb of recreative song the epic hopes of a people. At the same time, Vulcan of sovereign fires, where imperishable shields and swords were beaten out from spirits tempered in heaven. Look in the crystal, see how he hastens on to the place where his path comes up to the path of a child of Plutarch and Shakespeare. O Lincoln, actor indeed, playing well your part. And Booth, who strode in a mimic play within the play, often and often I saw you, as the cawing crows winged their way to the wood, over my housetop at solemn sunsets, there, by my window, alone. James Garber. Do you remember, passer-by, the path I wore across the lot where now stands the Opera House, hasting with swift feet to work through many years, take its meaning to heart? You too may walk, after the hills at Miller's Ford seem no longer far away, long after you see them near at hand, beyond 4 miles of meadow. And after woman's love is silent, saying no more, I will save you. And after the faces of friends and kindred become as faded photographs, pitifully silent, sad for the look which means, we cannot help you. And after you no longer reproach mankind with being in league against your soul's uplifted hands, themselves compelled at midnight and at noon to watch with steadfast eye their destinies, after you have these understandings, think of me and of my path, who walked therein and knew that neither man nor woman, neither toil nor duty, gold nor power, can ease the longing of the soul, the loneliness of the soul. Aaron Hatfield. Better than granite, Spoon River, is the memory picture you keep of me, standing before the pioneer men and women there at Concord Church on Communion Day, speaking in broken voice of the peasant youth of Galilee who went to the city and was killed by bankers and lawyers, my voice mingling with the June wind that blew over wheat fields from Atterbury, while the white stones in the burying ground around the church shimmered in the summer sun. And there, though my own memories were too great to bear, were you, O pioneers, with bowed heads breathing forth your sorrow, for the sons killed in battle, and the daughters, and little children who vanished in life's morning, or at the intolerable hour of noon. But in those moments of tragic silence, when the wine and bread were passed, came the reconciliation for us the ploughmen and the hewers of wood, us the peasants, brothers of the peasant of Galilee. To us came the comforter and the consolation of tongues of flame. Isaiah Beethoven. They told me I had 3 months to live, so I crept to Bernadotte and sat by the mill for hours and hours, where the gathered waters deeply moving seemed not to move. O world, that's you. You are but a widened place in the river, where life looks down and we rejoice for her, mirrored in us, and so we dream, and turn away. But when again we look for the face, behold the lowlands and blasted cottonwood trees where we empty into the larger stream. But here by the mill the castled clouds mocked themselves in the dizzy water, and over its agate floor at night the flame of the moon ran under my eyes, amid a forest stillness broken by a flute in a hut on the hill. At last, when I came to lie in bed, weak and in pain, with the dreams about me, the soul of the river had entered my soul, and the gathered power of my soul was moving, so swiftly it seemed to be at rest, under cities of cloud and under spheres of silver and changing worlds, until I saw a flash of trumpets above the battlements over time. Here's one you might not be expecting. The Village Atheist. Ye young debaters over the doctrine of the soul's immortality, I who lie here was the village atheist, talkative, contentious, versed in the arguments of the infidels. But through a long sickness, coughing myself to death, I read the Upanishads and the poetry of Jesus, and they lighted a torch of hope and intuition and desire which the shadow, leading me swiftly through the caverns of darkness, could not extinguish. Listen to me, ye who live in the senses, and think through the senses only. Immortality is not a gift. Immortality is an achievement, and only those who strive mightily shall possess it. The next one is Peleg Pog. Horses and men are just alike. There was my stallion, Billy Lee, black as a cat and trim as a deer, with an eye of fire keen to start, and he could hit the fastest speed of any racer around Spoon River. But just as you'd think he couldn't lose, with his lead of 50 yards or more, he'd rear himself and throw the rider, and fall back over tangled up, completely gone to pieces. You see, he was a perfect fraud. He couldn't win, he couldn't work, he was too light to haul or plow with, and no one wanted colts from him. And when I tried to drive him, well, he ran away and killed me. Westerners do have sort of a sense of, when that's the facts and there's nothing you can change them, well, that's that. All right, this next one is called Hod Put. Here I lie close to the grave of old Bill Pearsall, who grew rich trading with the Indians and who, afterwards, took the bankrupt law and emerged from it richer than ever. Myself, grown tired of toil and poverty, and beholding how old Bill and others grew in wealth, robbed a traveller one night near Proctor's Grove, killing him unwittingly while doing so, for the which I was tried and hanged. That was my way of going into bankruptcy. Now we who took the bankrupt law in our respective ways sleep peacefully, side by side. Let's hear next from Lois Spears. Here lies the body of Lois Spears, born Lois Fluke, daughter of Willard Fluke, wife of Cyrus Spears, mother of Myrtle and Virgil Spears, children with clear eyes and sound limbs. I was born blind. I was the happiest of women as wife, mother, and housekeeper, caring for my loved ones and making my home a place of order and bounteous hospitality, for I went about the rooms and about the garden with an instinct as sure as sight, as though there were eyes in my fingertips. Glory to God in the highest. This next one is Lucinda Matlock. I went to the dances at Chandlerville and played snap-out at Winchester. One time we changed partners, driving home in the moonlight of middle June, and then I found Davis. We were married and lived together for 70 years, enjoying, working, raising the 12 children, 8 of whom we lost, ere I had reached the age of 60. I spun, I wove, I kept the house, I nursed the sick. I made the garden, and for holiday, rambled over the fields where sang the larks, and by Spoon River gathering many a shell, and many a flower and medicinal weed, shouting to the wooded hills, singing to the green valleys. At 96 I had lived enough, that is all, and passed to a sweet repose. What is this I hear of sorrow and weariness, anger, discontent, and drooping hopes? Degenerate sons and daughters, life is too strong for you. It takes life to love life. This last one is called Fiddler Jones. The earth keeps some vibration going there in your heart, and that is you. And if the people find you can fiddle, why, fiddle you must for all your life. What do you see, a harvest of clover, or a meadow to walk through to the river? The wind's in the corn, you rub your hands, for beeves hereafter ready for market. Or else you hear the rustle of skirts, like the girls when dancing at Little Grove. To Cooney Potter a pillar of dust, or whirling leaves meant ruinous drought. They look to me like red-head Sammy's stepping it off to Tooraloor. How could I till my 40 acres, not to speak of getting more, with a medley of horns, bassoons, and piccolos, stirred in my brain by crows and robins, and the creak of a windmill, only these? And I never started to plow in my life that someone did not stop in the road and take me away to a dance or a picnic. I ended up with 40 acres, I ended up with a broken fiddle, and a broken laugh, and 1,000 memories, and not one single regret. Our next story may not be a Western, in the strictest sense of the word, but certainly people in the West had to help each other out, or we never would have had a West. So this is a little story called Mrs. Malone by Eleanor Fargeon. It was first published in 1950. Mrs. Malone lived hard by a wood, all on her lonesome, as nobody should, with her crust on a plate and her pot on the coal, and none but herself to converse with, poor soul. In a shawl and a hood she got sticks out of doors, on a bit of old sacking she slept on the floor, and nobody, nobody asked how she fared, or knew how she managed, for nobody cared. Why make a bother about an old crone? What for should they bother with Mrs. Malone? One Monday in winter with snow on the ground, so thick that a footstep fell without sound, she heard a faint frost-bitten peck on the pane, and went to the window to listen again. There sat a cock-sparrow bedraggled and weak, with half-open eyelid and ice on its beak. She threw up the sash, and she took the bird in, and mumbled and fumbled it under her chin. "Ye're all of a smother, ye're fair overblown. I've room for another," said Mrs. Malone. Come Tuesday, while eating her dry morning slice, with the sparrow a-picking, "Ain't company nice?" She heard on her doorpost a curious scratch, and there was a cat with its claw on the latch. It was hungry and thirsty and thin as a lath, it mewed and it mowed on the slithery path. She threw the door open and warmed up some pap, and huddled and cuddled it in her old lap. "There, there, little brother, ye poor skin and bone, there's room for another," said Mrs. Malone. Come Wednesday, while all of them crouched on the mat, with a crumb for the sparrow and a sip for the cat, there was wailing and whining outside in the wood, and there sat a vixen with six of her brood. She was haggard and ragged and worn to a shred, and her half-dozen babies were only half-fed. But Mrs. Malone, crying, "My, ain't they sweet!" happed them and lapped them and gave them to eat. "Ye warm yourself, mother, ye cold as a stone, there's room for another," said Mrs. Malone. Come Thursday a donkey stepped in off the road, with sores on its withers from bearing a load. Come Friday, when icicles pierced the white air, down from the mountainside lumbered a bear. For each she had something, if little, to give. Lord knows the poor critters must all of them live. She gave them her sacking, her hood, and her shawl, her loaf and her teapot she gave them her all. What with one thing and t'other, me family's grown, and there's room for another, said Mrs. Malone. Come Saturday evening, when time was to sup, Mrs. Malone had forgot to sit up. The cat said, "Meow," and the sparrow said, "Peep." The vixen, "She's sleeping." The bear, "Let her sleep." On the back of the donkey they bore her away, through trees and up mountains, beyond night and day, till come Sunday morning they brought her in state, through the last cloud bank, as far as the gate. "Who is it?" asked Peter, "you have with you there?" And donkey and sparrow, cat, vixen, and bear, exclaimed, "Do you tell us up here she's unknown? It's our mother, God bless us, it's Mrs. Malone, whose havings were few, and whose holding was small, and whose heart was so big it had room for us all." Then Mrs. Malone of a sudden awoke. She rubbed her two eyeballs and anxiously spoke, "Where am I, to goodness, and what do I see? Oh, my dears, let's turn back. This ain't no place for me." But Peter said, "Mother, go into the throne. There's room for another one, Mrs. Malone." I hope you've enjoyed our time together today. This is Samantha Dickens, a volunteer reader with Sunsounds of Arizona.
Next on Recording Library of West Texas Radio, the Noon Book Hour, followed by the Coronavirus Update at 1. Saturday on Recording Library of West Texas Radio's Saturday Night Movie, the hilarious Best Exotic Marigold Hotel.
Come and spend your autumn years in an Indian palace.
This is the day.
It's a luxury development where all the residents are in their golden years.
Like the coast of Florida?
Yeah, but with more elephants.
Flight 247 to Delhi is boarding now.
Would you like some of this? I believe it's called aloo carbonara.
Now, if I can't pronounce it, I don't want to eat it.
Is this your first time in India?
Yes. Do you think we'll be all right?
It's going to be extraordinary.
Welcome to the Best Exotic Marigold Hotel.
Prepare to be amazed.
I want to stay at the other hotel, the one that's in the brochure.
In India, we have a saying, everything will be all right in the end. So if it is not all right, it is not yet the end.
I have a dream to create a home for the elderly so wonderful that they will simply refuse to die.
Oh!
This man is dead. Must reserve his dignity.
Did I nod off?
India, like life itself, I suppose, is about what you bring to it.
I'm really loving this!
Are you all right? I just want a glass of water.
That was a gin and tonic.
I know that now.
The Best Exotic Marigold Hotel.
You're not worried about the danger of having sex at your age.
If she dies, she dies.
Judi Dench, Bill Nye, and Maggie Smith star in the audio-described The Best Exotic Marigold Hotel, Saturday night at 7 on Recording Library of West Texas Radio.
Now, here's your forecast for the Midland-Odessa area. It's 87 and clear. Tonight, partly cloudy with a low in the low 80s. Then, tomorrow, mostly cloudy with a high in the mid-90s. Tomorrow night, clear with a low in the low 80s. From the Recording Library of West Texas 24-Hour Weather Center, I'm Maria Lopez.
Coronavirus updates, weekdays at 1.
This is the Recording Library of West Texas. It's 12 noon.
It's time for the Noon Book Hour. Readings of books from all genres, handpicked by staff at the Recording Library of West Texas.
Hello again. This is Christina Abernathy for the Georgia Radio Reading Service with The Devil in the Junior League by Linda Francis Lee. This is the third reading from the book, which was published in 2006 by St. Martin's Press. And if you remember last time, Freddie discovered her husband Gordon had disappeared with his mistress and all of Freddie's money. Desperate to get back at her husband, she enlists the help of Howard Grout, a very successful but tacky attorney. He agrees to take her case on the condition that Freddie get his tacky wife, Nikki, accepted into the Junior League. And now we continue. I headed out of the Willows complex, waving at Juan in his limestone brick guardhouse as I slid through the exit. I needed time to sort through my options. I didn't want to be saved by men. Pampered, adored, put on a pedestal? Yes. But saved? No. But if I were to stand a chance of keeping my throne, I would need Howard Grout's help. The thought didn't sit well, especially since the price I would have to pay could very easily ruin me socially for life. The proverbial between a rock and a hard